From the silence so well constructed, I wander off into tomorrow, bending like a willow, trying to touch a world that's unhatched, this impossible of my imagination. All that is kept buried beneath the wounds of my stories, sometimes everything has to be studied, knowing somehow this sitting here, this knowing, this fierce walking, like pilgrims through the darkness, knowing we've traveled inside everyone, feeling the grief and the joys. I want to know, no more traveling on the wings of fear and hope, but to sip by this fire of living, no longer dying to what could have been, or even what will be, but finding my place in the things that are, some mystery presented, some grace, some bit of mercy miraculously lived. So let this listening, somewhere beneath the granite shelves of all this armoring, where the sweet waters of the heart lie waiting to be tapped, to give life back to itself. This basic goodness, this first step, the heart flowing with each encounter, a mind pliable, moving like a sweet stream from that deep down listening. I am awake. I am awake as the world calls in its pungent need to change me. I move into it with it. So, one of my poems to start, just because it's fun. You know? And also how I look at things. So, this retreat is based on the Brahma Viharas, the abode of the gods. And so when I think of the abode of the gods, it's these practices of basically first, it's based on the heart and how the heart experiences itself. So I thought I'd start with, when I think of what these fundamentals are, is this will be my second pilgrimage to a place called Mount Kailash in Tibet, which has a mountain that they always say looks like a crystal. And a crystal has, in this case, there's the north side and the south side and the east side and the west side. And it's very much there is the mountain itself, which is the heart itself, and then there are aspects of it. There's what the word we call metta, which is just really, it's that that simple kindness which is inherent in a human being, you know. There's compassion, another side of the mountain. There is the sympathetic joy and the equanimity of the heart. Which is the whole mountain itself, you know. I'm going in again in May to take a group up the mountain. And, it's a bit of a struggle in the sense whenever we go on these paths, there are things that we don't expect or can't know that we encounter. In the same way, when we sit here and we get really quiet, we're not so sure what's going to appear, you know? And sometimes stories or sometimes feelings, sometimes from ancient times, sometimes from yesterday. But the practice to me is so simple in the sense that one of my teachers always said, you know, he talked about, his name is Lama Tupten Yeshe. He was a great, great teacher. And one of his wonderful qualities was his loving kindness. You know, it was palatable when you walked in the room. There was he always would say he had funny statements like, you were my mother in another life. He's Tibetan, you know. So, you know, but it was always that kind of thing, like, oh, there's somehow, there's something really special about you that that deserves my attention and my kindness, you know. He also had another habit of, he'd give you something and say thank you, you know. So, I mean, it was just out of nowhere, you know. And at first you kind of would get a little confused, and then you realized, oh, where was this coming from? Was how he was looking at the world, you know. And our practice here is really based on that truth that, yes, we're on a journey. And that journey, you know, I always think of it in Ajahn Chah had this language, the great Thai forest teacher, that if you could really see, he used the words into the three characteristics. If you could see into those characteristics, then the heart would naturally open, you know? And I think it's part of the fundamentals of just sitting and getting really quiet and listening. You know, sometimes I do know that, you know, what comes up sometimes are some of the old stories, the unpleasantness, and it feels uncomfortable, you know. But again, part of the principles of the whole practice is that it's referred to as a practice of purification. It's kind of to take out sometimes the confusion and the poisons that hold us in captivity, you know? And sometimes we get so busy that we bypass all of it. And then you come and sit down and shut up, you know? And the next thing you know, there you are, you know? Old story, old feeling, and you get caught, you know? It's not who you are, because that's really what we're talking about. When we talk about this truth of what is metta, what is this kindness, and how does it, in the sense not how, what it is, but it's the fact that how do we get to it or hold it in some way. So I like these, in the sense, the characteristics, because and each of us seems to have a door to go into this, to get to it, you know, to get to that open heart. And for some of us, it may be, and there are different stages of this as we go along. Sometimes it's just suffering, you know? It's just plain old suffering, you know? And that somehow, that it kind of undoes us and has to see what's under there, the tenderness that's underneath. Sometimes that pain or confusion that's there, you know, unfortunately. And other times, it's just seeing the sheer nothing is what it appears to be. It's always in constant flux and change, you know, and somehow that with that, it kind of uproots all of our concepts of how we think it is or should be or should have been in some way. And so it's really that seeing into the impermanent reality, the phenomena of what this life and experience is about. You know. And for some, it's just seeing into, you know, they use the word anatta, no self, or Ajahn Chah would just say empty of, you know, any kind of inherent thing itself. No. And to see into that, you know, is to kind of let go just naturally of your belief and your story about all this. you know. And that when all this, whether it's through the impermanence or whether it's through suffering or whether it's through just seeing it, that in the disidentification, that there is something underneath all this. And it's always been there, you know. And it's to understand that sometimes I haven't used the word love because I think it's a very complicated and confusing word in our culture. You know, I always say, you know, that Tibetans have 13 words for mind. We have one, you know. And we have one word for love. And, you know, there's sort of the relational and the business kind of part of love, you know. But I always have for, I don't know, I was thinking it's been over 20 years, I've been reading the same thing because it is the clearest thing to me, the explanation of what the difference between love and what metta actually is. So I'll read, it's from Stephen Levine, Who Dies, written many, many years ago. But boy, it kind of clarifies it in so many ways. We use the word love, but we have no more understanding of love than we do of anger or fear or jealousy or even joy, because we seldom investigate what the state of mind is. What are the feelings we so quickly label as love? For many, what is called love is not lovely at all, but is a tangle of needs and desires, of momentary ecstasies and bewilderment. Moments of unity, of intense feelings of closeness, occur in a mind so fragile that the least squint or sideways glance shatters its oneness into a dozen ghostly paranoias. When we say love, we usually mean some emotion, some deep feeling for an object or a person that momentarily allows us to open to another. But in such emotional love, self-protection is never very far away. Still, there is, quote, business to the relationship, clouds of jealousy, possessiveness, guilt, intentional and unintentional manipulation, separateness, and the shadows of all previous, quote, loves darken the light of oneness. But what I mean by love is not an emotion. It is a state of being, and this is where that word metta comes in. It's a state of being. True love has no object. Many speak of their unconditional love for another. Unconditional love is the experience of being. There's no I and other, and anyone or anything is experienced in love. You cannot unconditionally love someone. You can only be. You can only be unconditional love. It is not in a dualistic emotion. It is a sense of oneness with all that is. The experience of love arises when we surrender our separateness into the universal. The experience of love arises when we surrender our separateness into the universal. It is a feeling of unity. You don't love another. You are another. There is no fear because there is no separation. So I think it's the best explanation I can come as Stephen's kind of wording of this. Because, you know, in our traditional sense, we come in and there's all these kind of personal stories that you're sitting there. I know you're supposed to just watch your breath and stuff, but I know better, you know. There's a lot more going on in there, you know. But there's also what's true is that as you begin to notice and in the sense of you get caught up, but then there's a moment where you remember what you're doing. You come back to your breath. You come back to your body. You're sitting there, you know. And that's not a problem, you know. And you do that over and over, and it begins to break down. And what we're doing here in this time is actually our practice is, even though we get caught, is to keep remembering that if we can sit in the center of ourselves, there is a knowing and a separating out from, you can use the kind of the, what I was going to use the word selfish, you know, this kind of selfing that is always about who and how we think we are, that we're a lot more than that. And that's where this whole, this metta, which is really a universal principle, you know, that holds all of us all the time, you know. But due to our desire, due to our fears, our hope and fear, that we actually imprint over it constantly. So our practice here is just getting to, you know, I know that there's very kind of formal metta practice in the sense of a doing practice. But just in the sitting practice, just allowing yourself to recognize that underneath all of the chatter, all of the likes and dislikes, that there is something that is natural, you know, and it's not contrived. It is something that, yes, it's a universal. It's something that is not separate from you or me. It's something that we all, when there's a kind of clarity and openness and a fearlessness, that what exists is this incredible kindness, you know? It actually is not something we make up, okay? It's something when we see through and get out of our own way that the natural existence of this openness and kindness and sense of non-separateness is actually who you are, you know. And so all these practices fundamentally, you know, I always love the, I always use this example because it struck me in the 60s, you know, was this whole piece, my teacher, this same teacher, you know, you'd go in and he'd say, "My mind," you know, and he would be pointing there, and I'd go, "Oh man, this guy doesn't know much about anatomy, does he?" You know? And but as I went along and I began to really work with these practices, I began to see that, oh, he was absolutely right. You know, we train, in essence, so much of Buddhist practice is to train the mind. To train the mind to get out of the way, fundamentally. And when it gets out of the way, then the mind is here. It's in the heart, you know. And we began to understand that the, you know, really the highest endeavor here is based on that when we've kind of, you know, I use the word purification, when we've kind of seen through a lot of our mythologies, you know, that we have seen through these mythologies and see the attachment and see the fear and see the desire, that if we see through that somewhat, then what's underneath there? What's going on underneath there? It's very simple, you know. You don't have to make up anything about it, you know. And, you know, there's one of the quotes that's from A Course in Miracles that, you know, do not search for love, but just to know all the things that prevent you from it, you know. And so a lot of this is to untangle, you know, to kind of allow sometimes the suffering to inform us, not to overwhelm us or lose us, but just to inform us of how life happens, you know. It is not something we're trying to escape from. It's something to be realized, you know, and that there is a practice in the sense there's a lot of things we can't get out of the way of, you know, unfortunately. But we can also, if there's a sense of understanding of the impermanence, understanding that, you know, that is part of nature. And this is, in a way, it's hard to say because our culture is so into personal, an impersonal process, you know, due to certain things. And we choose our attitude towards it. And so you choose how you want to be with it, you know. And I hope that in this understanding that we began to choose not the fear and the contraction and the kind of the possessiveness, but actually the truth that your natural instinct, when it's not caught up in itself or trying to hold its old stories, that there is a simple, you know, sense of gratitude and kindness that naturally comes, you know, and that our practice is to cultivate that, you know. And so, you know, it's to release the past and the discomforts or the longings for things, but to start to cultivate. To me, there is a doing practice of, you know, I had someone that the only thing they could do was their only practice for a year was they would get up and do 20 minutes of practice saying, "May I be safe." You know, that's all they did was, "May I be safe." You know, and it was enough. You know, after a year where then they began to, in a sense, that helped untangle a huge contraction that held them in captivity, you know. And they were good-hearted. But just due to past and circumstances, and I know for myself, I've come out of pretty, you know, difficult family circumstances. And if anything, it encouraged me. You know, it took me a long time to see that that was the teachers I needed. I didn't like them, you know. But it was the teachers I needed in some sense that if this is the path I wanted to take and was this the journey, the road I was going to walk, then I know when I first went to India in the 60s and my whole life was all based on, it was called burning bridges, you know, all my connections, everything. I thought, oh, I could go to India and I would just disappear, you know. And you know, I thought that was possible. But when I got there, after a while and meeting great teachers, I began to see, oh no, I had to actually begin to own the things that I didn't even want to look at. And not only did I not want to look at, I actually had, this is how ignorant I was, I didn't even know I'd suffered. You know? And I remember, you know, finally when I sat down and said, oh, I'm just going to sit here, I just cried, you know. It was like, oh, there was this whole backlog of, you know, the rebel and that, you know, who didn't like their circumstance, so they ran. And they ran as far as they possibly could, you know, only to meet themselves, you know. And in meeting the self was suddenly, and then realizing being asked to study it and find out what it was that was, you know, holding this old captive, you know, prisoner. You know, and I think a lot of that stuff sometimes doesn't really go away. You are who you are, by the way. You have your history with all of its warts and things, you know? But to be authentic, to really be yourself, you know, is to find out that you had fabulous teachers, you know, who were ruthless, to get you to open, you know. And it's not that it's fair, but did anybody say this was going to be fair? No, not really. No. It was just your willingness to kind of step out and say, okay, how can I untangle all the stories and histories and difficulties? This is something, I don't know actually who wrote this. I got it from my friend Peter Russell, who a scientist, a British scientist, writes great books. His first book was in the 70s. Actually, Baba Ram Dass turned me on to him. He wrote a book called The Global Brain, you know, really about the whole Gaia theory and how we live on such a fascinating planet that is constantly teaching us that it heals itself. You know, in so many ways, the water shouldn't be stay as constant. The temperatures on this earth for life shouldn't stay as constant. It's miraculous, right? That this all goes on without us doing anything, you know, except for trying to, we won't get into that, you know, the consequences of greed. But, you know. Love is not something you do. It is not how you behave. There's nothing you can do that constitutes loving another. No action that is of itself loving. Love is a way of being. And more than that, it is simply being. Simply being. Being with another person, however they may be, holding no judgments, having no agendas, no need to have them experience your love, no desire to demonstrate love, no intrusion upon their soul, nothing but a total acceptance of their being, born of your acceptance of yours. And this is the whole practice, you know. It's actually taking responsibility I think there's always intention, which is really important to me, you know. That you know the intention and motivation why you're doing this, you know. And what I see is actually, it's my capacity to open and see life and love life as long as it's offered to me. This is an unknown story. You know? And, you know, I love the, speaking of Stephen Levine, you know, he was at some workshop on, you know, who dies and stuff, and he asked how many people were going to die in the room, and half of the people raised their hand, you know. And, you know, you don't really get it, you know. You know. So, but there are all these things that if we could be a little more awake, you know, a little more awake, if you really knew that all you've saved up, all you've gotten, all of it's got to go, you know. None of it's going to stay, you know. And somehow knowing that, there is this sense of, can I be responsible knowing that? And so there is in the kind of open heart, there's also this wisdom and knowledge of the truth and how it works, you know, which then gives you the power, you know, the fearless power to act in a way that magnifies that basic goodness, that basic good heart. Somehow we always think we're going to win this, you know. But actually there's just no winning and losing, you know. There's only waking up. That's all there is. It's just waking up, you know. Some days you're going to lose. Some days you're going to win, you know. But it's not enough, you know. They're due to effort and circumstances, sometimes beyond our control and sometimes in our control. But it shouldn't be the criteria, you know. The criteria should be, you know, can I ask myself about what and who I am in this, you know, very short, maybe 100 years, but maybe tonight, you know? And we forget. No. We're going to go on forever, right? Aren't you? You know? So it's a piece of, you know, to understand, to have the wisdom of that also means that one then recognizes the exceptional experience of beauty and the gift. You all are so privileged just being here. You know, someone gave for you to be here. That's the way it's kind of works. It's kind of that, you know, what's a pay ahead or something like that. It's, you know, but it's true, you know? And it's all about teaching yourself about a gift, you know, and can you accept the gift? Not by turning away from, but allowing it to actually infuse and inhabit you in a way that, you know, opens your eyes, you know. And this doesn't have to be a grim thing here, you know. Even if you don't look at somebody, you can still smile. You know, and I think there's a, Thich Nhat Hanh has this thing of, you know, it's kind of like an AA, you fake it till you make it, you know. So sometimes maybe it's worth just kind of grinning a little when you're sitting there and kind of putting a smile on your face, just because, you know. And if you actually took and reviewed how this is happening, you would understand, you know. I mean, every year I have to go back to Asia, you know, twice last year. And there's something about, you know, sometimes particularly in train stations and stuff where it's, you know, the chaos is so great, but there is a self-organizing principle somehow that it kind of works in some way, you know. And there isn't so much fear around it. It's just, you know, yes, you have to have patience and all that other stuff, but it sort of works, you know. And here we have this great expectation that somehow it's all going to work this way, you know. And gives us this great illusion of incredible amount of control, you know. And that control, in some ways, when it's misunderstood on some level, that somehow, because it kind of in sense empowers somewhat, that we miss the possibility that, oh, I've narrowed my world down to very small, you know. And these practices are that somehow you need to kind of get over yourself. Also see that you think in words, You know, and that what we're really trying to do is get over our words somehow, and actually give ourselves permission to, in a sense, kind of feel just the beauty that's inherent. Even when the body's uncomfortable, you can still feel that. You know, it is still your birthright to feel what's under there. I love pilgrimages, you know. It seems like my life has been so many different pilgrimages, and there's always destination. But the thing that's beautiful about pilgrimage is that somehow you're not going to get somewhere. No. It's not different than a retreat. You're actually, every breath, every corner you turn, something new appears, and that is always in the back of your mind, that there is something that you're moving towards, that universal, or that, you know, I liken the two truths, that kind of the absolute or the transpersonal, that is available to you. You know, not to get lost in it, but simply to keep the possibility that when the mind is open and the heart is open, and one, in a sense, keeps going breath by breath, step by step, you know, then it is no different than this training. This is simply a pilgrimage in time. You know, and sometimes you go down into kind of dark gullies and you can't see the sky. And other times you'll come up and there'll be the moon shining, you know. So, maybe to end here, I'll just read my poem again, since I like to do that. From this silence, so well constructed, I wander off into tomorrow, bending like a willow, trying to touch a world that's unhatched. This impossible of my imagination. All that is kept buried beneath these wounds of my stories. Sometimes everything has to be studied. Knowing somehow this sitting here, this knowing, this fierce walking like pilgrims through the darkness, knowing we've traveled inside everyone, feeling the joys and the grief. No more traveling on the wings of fear and hope, but to sit by this fire of living, no longer dying to what could have been, or even what will be, but finding my place in the things that are, some mystery presented, some grace, some bit of mercy miraculously lived. So let this listening, somewhere beneath the granite shelves of my armoring, where the sweet waters of the heart lie waiting to be tapped, to give life back to itself. This basic goodness, this first step home, giving you back to yourself, the heart flowing with each encounter. A mind pliable, moving like the sweet stream from this deep down listening. I am awake. I am awake. As the world calls in its pungent need to change me, I move into it, with it. So let's just sit for a moment. So see if you can't just feel in the center of your being, this good heart. There's nothing to be done. Just to feel it. It's in the center of your being. Is your mind knowing it, and your body inhabiting, living it? As you hold this mind and this body and heart, just expanding it out in this room. And this truth that there actually is no separateness. I am you. You are me. And we are all together.